I've got a great show lined up for you today. On today's show, episode 18, Depression. I'm going to talk about the topic of depression and offer some thoughts and insights. For the question of today, I'm going to answer the question, explain more about putting people up on a pedestal, or as Lao Tzu put it, overesteeming people. Coming up on your favorite show, Cup of Tao, starting right now.
You're listening to Cup of Tao with your host, Chris L. McClish. Chris is a man with many roles, many journeys, and one spirit.
Hi, how are you doing today? I hope you're having a good day, or at least that you will have a good day or you'll get through it somehow. Way back in episode one, for those of you that had been listening for a while, I mentioned that the more we try to fight emotions, the stronger that they become. Which meant that if we didn't want to have something like anxiety, the more we try to push it away, sometimes the stronger it becomes. The more we don't want it, the more it's there. Logically, one could take that and ask me if I mean that if you have severe depression or what they call clinical depression, that you shouldn't try to do anything about it and that you should live with the depressing thoughts and feelings. And that's not what I'm saying at all. I hope nowhere and at no time am I misinterpreted. And trust me, I've been misinterpreted. I guess that the nature of doing a show, people will misunderstand your intent, twist your words, or as we always do, apply our own interpretations. This is where I want to make some clarifications. First, let me say this. There are some good therapists out there. And there's good doctors. If you need medications to keep yourself level or keep yourself from harm, self-harm, or even to keep yourself alive, then don't hesitate and please seek medical expertise and follow your provider's direction. I want to accomplish several things in this podcast, and it may get confusing if you don't understand that my first message is to get medical help if you need it. In this podcast, I also want to normalize a certain level of sadness or depression, but I don't want that to detract from my first message. And I fear that that's going to happen based on misinterpretations that have happened from previous podcast episodes. It's very sad that so many people have had such severe depression. Some of those have not found the treatment yet that works for them, and it may take several trials. And like I said, there's also some good therapists out there. My first message is, if you feel like you're about to harm yourself, get help now. Call 911. There's also a suicide prevention hotline too. I think that's national for those listening in other countries. The number is 1-800-273-8255. You may be one of my listeners that is saying, well, this doesn't apply to me. I'm not suicidal right now. I'm not severely depressed. But someone else listening may be. I want you to live, and there's help out there. My second message is, no one wants to admit, but most therapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists will deny what I'm getting ready to say. Most people have depressive thoughts. I'm not talking about those who are actively wanting to kill themselves right now, whom my first message is directed to. And I want to go a step further with most people having depressive thoughts. Even mental health professionals have had self-critical thoughts, and some of them have even had some pretty dark, depressive thoughts. What makes me believe this? Well, I have supervised, worked with, and treated many psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists, doctors, and nurses. I've been a psychotherapist to many health professionals. I've even had lunch and deep conversation with colleagues who are mental health professionals. And I can tell you that no professional is immune from suffering as well as having some dark thoughts. Someone will misinterpret what I'm saying and say, so this guy's saying all therapists and psychiatrists are depressed or suicidal. Or even further, take this to mean that the mental health field is a joke. Or they may ask, how can professionals help if they are not immune to mental suffering? I say that vulnerability is not necessarily a weakness. It helps therapists and professionals relate better to the suffering of their clients. Now, I wouldn't go ask your therapist or psychiatrist if they ever thought such depressing thoughts or even had fleeting suicidal thoughts, because they're not your client. They are there for you. There are many reasons why your professional may not do self-disclosure, including a fear that he or she may be seen as impaired, or worse, a fear of having his or her license stripped away. It is a risk for a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist to self-disclose, but some do. So what's my point to all this? I have 2 points. The first is to point out that we all suffer. None of us are immune. I want you to know that most people don't go through the day being all happy and joyful, that most people have self-critical thoughts from time to time. Yeah, there are people out there that are chronically happy, yet most people have a range of thoughts and emotions. And I will tell you with conviction that the people that you think are happy all day may really not be. And again, I want to emphasize people are on a continuum. There's probably people listening that'll say, well, I've never been really depressed, or I've never even thought about death. I've just had some self-critical thoughts. And that's fine. I'm not saying that every single person has that, but I'm telling you that most people don't go through the day without having some self-critical thoughts at minimum, regardless of even if they're a mental health professional. The healthy person is able to latch on to some good things, to have the ability to find joy and not pay as much attention to mean things that his or her mind throws out as being factual, as opposed to seeing it as mental interpretation. I can't emphasize enough that this is on a continuum, ranging from those that are truly kind of happy-go-lucky to those who see everything as a never-ending pattern of doom and gloom. I also don't want someone severely depressed to hear me saying, oh, okay, so everyone is depressed, so I don't need to get help, because I don't want to be misinterpreted. My second point is that we tend to give our depressive thoughts power. We believe our mind when it tells us that our life sucks, that we are inadequate, and similar criticisms that our mind throws at us. Even when our mind tells us the truth, it doesn't often give us the whole truth or provide options to overcome our limitations and the obstacles in front of us. Our mind magnifies and often blinds us from seeing the healthy options that are there, that are available to us. Our mind's interpretations allow our mind to feed our depression with more depression. Let me explain. A person says that he or she doesn't feel like getting out of the house, doesn't feel like socializing or asking a friend to dinner, because he or she listens to the mind, which says things like, you're too depressed, you're too tired, you're too unmotivated, and things will go badly as they always do. It will not help you to get out of the house anyway. Then, when we listen to that message, we avoid behaviors which may not immediately help us, but they may train us in the long run to do healthy behaviors despite what our mind tells us. I know that sounds confusing. Let me give you an example. When I was working at the hospital, I would often encounter the person who would say, I was too depressed to get out of bed and socialize or go to the coffee shop. And I had to be careful how I approached the conversation, because if I went too fast into pointing out that if you stay in bed, how likely is it that your depression will get better? Because if I said that, sometimes people would respond with, you obviously don't know how bad my depression is. Also, I don't want you to hear me saying that if someone is depressed, that it's his or her fault for not doing enough. Again, I know I keep saying this, but it's really easy to misinterpret what I'm saying. I do want to point out that getting better does involve forcing oneself to take some measures outside one's comfort zone. Staying in bed reinforces depression. Not socializing reinforces depression. Now, when people would get out of bed, they would typically say, I did what you said. I got out of bed and went to the coffee shop and talked to the barista, and I don't feel any better. It didn't work. My depression's still there. So I had to gently remind people that there's no quick fixes or miraculous cures, and that by getting out of bed and doing something, you were helping to train your brain to do new healthy activities and behaviors, even if it didn't feel like your depression was getting better immediately. When I would do groups on the mental health unit of a hospital, people would go to groups, and some of them really wanted to be in the group, and some of them would fold their arms, look disgusted. Sometimes they would even fall off asleep. Sometimes these were people that had been in mental health wards before or hospitals and felt like nothing would help them, so they would kind of close their mind to the group. But I found out something interesting. Even the people that came to group that fell asleep or that acted disinterested, they usually did better than the ones that avoided the group, that stayed in bed and felt like, you know, I'm just going to stay here in this bed. My depression's so bad, there's nothing I can do about it. So you would think that going to group and rejecting it would be worse than maybe not being able to get out of bed or not getting out of bed to go to the group. I have a theory, and I think it's right about why the people that went to group, even if they were disinterested, tended to get better. Because just by walking from their rooms, the few 50 feet or 30 feet or whatever it was to the group room, they were mentally training themselves. I'm going to do something to get better. I'm going to do something about this. Make sense? You may want to call the things that we do to deal with depression as fighting our depression, as many recent popular books call it. Yet, I worry that if we feel like we're fighting, we are giving our mind too much power over us. And if we go further and tell ourselves that we absolutely cannot be depressed, and say, I just can't be depressed, my depression is ruining my life, it almost puts the depression as being more powerful than us. It has the unintended consequence of making it stronger. It's like saying to the depression, I can't have you here in my life. Oh no, you're here. Now I'm even more depressed because I can't get rid of you. So what do we do to deal with it? I think a variety of things can help. 1, practice mindfulness. Listen back if you haven't already heard my episodes on look, listen, label, and let it be, described in previous episodes, the 4 L's. 2, don't be afraid to ask for help and be willing to receive that help. Help can be professional, support groups, medications, and even other people. 3, do healthy things. Remember, I think a holistic approach is good. Eat more healthy foods, exercise, avoid abuse of medicines or intoxicants, partake in hobbies or interest. Remember, it takes time and effort. Usually depression doesn't disappear overnight. 4, find spiritual resources such as books, worship centers, places that give you a sense of awe or that inspire you. 5, find a symbol. Just as a wedding ring is a symbol of commitment, find a symbol that represents your commitment to your new way of being. I know people in addiction recovery have carried things with them like a recovery or sobriety coin, and I've seen people carry all sorts of things or wear things. Remember that we go further downhill when we trust our depressive and critical thoughts, when we believe them, or when we act in unhealthy ways of reacting instead of taking healthy actions. As I mentioned in the Change Our Thoughts episode, there are obstacles in our mind and in our surrounding that we must find a way around. And we can see our thoughts as being part of those obstacles. Mindfulness has 3 major aspects. One of them is to not trust our mind, or to put it another way, to see our thoughts as thoughts. 2, to be more fully present in the here and now. What's the 3rd thing? Well, that's for a later show, and it has to do with more of a spiritual aspect. Your assignment is, if you're depressed, or even if you're not depressed, even if you're experiencing self-critical thoughts and some depressive feelings, do something about it today. Take action today. Time for the question of today. Today's question of the day comes from a meetup group. I meet up with a group of people interested in Taoism, and a woman named Chris asks, explain more about overesteeming people, as Lao Tzu put it, to overesteem people, or if you've heard the expression, putting people up on a pedestal, that would apply here. My answer to the question is I notice that we run a couple of risks when we put people up on a pedestal and we overesteem them. One risk is that we seem to run the risk of taking everything they say as the gospel truth, and we might even engage in groupthink, which is where we change our beliefs based on what the idol or the figurehead, or if it's not a person, if it's like a movement or a party, we run the risk of changing all our thinking and values to line up with that groupthink, with that general message. And that in turn can also put you in jeopardy of things like if the leader does things like engages in ethical violations or does contrary to your own values, then you tend to not believe it or ignore those things, downplay them. In this case, you might be thinking of politicians that have retained followers who support their every move, even when it conflicts with the followers' morals, religious beliefs, and other beliefs. In the United States, in the political parties, which are dividing the country, Democrat and Republican, somebody who may have been 60% Republican and 40% Democrat, if they're watching Fox News every night and they're reading Facebook friends' posts on really conservative things, they might gravitate towards almost 90% conservative and start seeing the other side as bad. Likewise, if somebody was, say, 60% leaning to the left and 40% conservative, if they're watching MSNBC and CNN, and they're following posts on Facebook about how evil Trump is, then they might develop a group think of everything that the Republican Party does is bad. So both sides start seeing each side as being evil, and it's really hard not to get caught up in that. Same thing goes for religions. When you're in a religion, you might start believing that other religions are bad because they believe differently. Sometimes groupthink and idolizing somebody and overesteeming a person can lead to cult-like behavior. And I think a good definition for a cult is what Mike Rinder said on the TV show Scientology and its aftermath. He said something along the lines of, you can recognize a cult when you try to leave it. So if you're persecuted or tormented by its members, are ostracized even by your own family, then you know that the ideology has gone from agreeing to disagree or being entitled to your own beliefs to being extreme and cult-like, if not a cult itself. So one risk is when we idolize people, we tend to obey their every whim and command, that we start modifying our own beliefs, and we start minimizing when the leader of that movement or the leaders of that movement have done things that violate our own values. A second risk is this: when we overesteem people, we give them power over us. When we put them up on a pedestal, when we idolize them, we give them power. And either we fall into risk number one, we start modifying our values and beliefs, even in the face of if they violate our values or our beliefs. Or we might throw out their teachings or philosophy when we reject the leader or we reject the movement. You've heard the expression, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Even in corrupt leaders and in corrupt movements, there might be some teachings that we can take away from, yet we tend to throw everything out if we find a flaw or a problem. When we overesteem, we often end up with leaders, celebrities, and bosses who see themselves as being infallible. And we ultimately wind up having human rights violations, unfair treatment of those who are different than the majority, and a change in the standard of what is allowed and accepted, either in society, the workplace, politics, or wherever. Now, you may think of this figurehead as being a person, but it can also be a movement or an ideology. In the USA, you have many people who see themselves, for example, as being loving, kind Christians, and Christianity teaches to accept all, including the sinner. Yet because of today's divisive climate, you'll see those who hold on to a political ideology, even in times when it conflicts with their own stated values, without the people even being aware, sometimes, of that contradiction. I heard the following example or allegory on another podcast that I listened to. I'm not sure which one it was. It might have been What's This Tao All About? On the podcast, they were talking about, suppose Jesus were to walk into a church today in some areas of the United States and profess his beliefs. What would happen? If he was in a really conservative area, he'd probably be quickly thrown out for his appearance. And when he spoke, he would be removed for what people would label as being a liberal hippie. Think about it. How would he be treated in areas of extreme conservatism? My challenge to you is, as best you can, try not to get too caught up in groupthink. Try to be an independent thinker. Try to find value even in opposing views, in some of them. You don't have to change the values that you hold dear, obviously. But try not to get caught up too much in thinking of the other side as being evil, politically, religiously, whatever it is. Chris, thank you so much for that question. It was such a good question. Season 2 of Cup of Tao is going to start soon without any or much of a break between the two seasons. And I'm going to have some cool episodes, such as one on having fun with mindfulness, where we'll do some fun exercises, an episode on Qi. And I hope to get an author, Bill Douglas, who wrote a book on Tai Chi, on the show. And I'm going to have an episode on being unique. In that episode, I'll cover things like ADHD and neurodiversity. So we got some cool episodes coming up that we're going to tie into Taoism. So I hope you stick around for season 2 of Cup of Tao. Thank you so much for listening. Before I let you go, here's a few messages.
Be sure and purchase my book, Accepting Life on Life's Terms, Taoist Psychology for Today's Uncertain Times. Look for the book wherever you buy books. Available in written and digital format.
Also, check out the show notes, where you'll find things like ways to support the show, my social media info for following me, and my email contact information, where you can ask me questions of today and get a hold of me about other things. That's all for today's show. Join me next week for another great episode. Until then, I hope you have a great week. May peace and love be with you. Thank you. I'll see you later.
Thanks for listening.
This concludes season 1 of Cup of Tao. Thank you for listening.